What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies. My name is Sarah Bramau Ramos, and I am one of the hosts on the channel. And I'm here today with Johan Elverskog to talk about his new book, his new translation, The Precious Summary, A History of the Mongols from Chinggis Khan to the Qing Dynasty. Welcome back to New Books, Johan, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me back. It truly is a pleasure to be here.
Great. So with that, as you know, the traditional question on the channel is, how did you come to the field? But you have already been asked that once on the network already, and I will link the episode for that, your answer to that question, in the blog description that accompanies this. So for a change, I was hoping you could talk about how you came to this book, The Precious Summary. So this text is, as I'm sure we will talk about, the most important work of Mongolian history written in 1662. But when did you first encounter and read it?
Oh, that's a great question. Almost have to kind of spool back to the initial question that you didn't want to ask of how I got into the field. I mean, so, but to kind of lay the groundwork of what I was doing in graduate school is I came into the field of Mongolian studies kind of through the back door from Tibetan studies. And in a certain sense, I wanted to figure out how Tibetan Buddhism became operational and how it, you know, historically entered Eurasian life and culture. And of course, you know, when you scratch the surface on that, of course, it wasn't the Tibetans that played a big role in that. It was the Mongolians. And so, when I went to graduate school at Indiana University, of course, I was studying Mongolian. And in kind of Mongolian studies, there's kind of three foci in a certain sense. Some people work on the empire period, and then there's people who work on the kind of the revolutionary 20th century period. And then there's the whole anthropological crowd, I mean, coming out of Cambridge University and other institutions like that. And so there's this massive gap, I guess, you know, using Chinese chronology, call it the Ming-Qing period, that's largely overlooked. Of course, there's certain scholars who worked on it, particularly Henry Sirois and Morris Rosabi and others. But that was kind of really my interest. So what happened during this period? And of course, there's always, you know, the big problem that everybody points to is like they claim that no sources available to study this period, and particularly Mongolian sources. But there are Mongolian sources, and particularly these Mongolian chronicles from the 17th century. And, you know, my idea, again, this was in the 90s. It was the height of kind of like ethno-nationalist scholarship and, you know, breakup of the Soviet Union, breakup of Yugoslavia, and everybody was, you know, creating new national narratives. And that was what pretty much everybody in the academy was writing and talking about. And so my interest was like, how did the Mongols write their history? You know, and you know, very quickly when you start looking at it, of course, all the contemporary or modern interpretations, you know, again, they blot out this period as a time of backwardness and Manchu colonialism. And, you know, let's not talk about it because it was a bad time. And so, but that was my interest, my, you know, what I wanted to kind of unravel. And then when you you know, to do that kind of work, of course, you need to need Chinese sources and Tibetan sources, but then also the Mongolian sources. So I read it beginning in graduate school, you know, and then, you know, to do any kind of, you know, history of the Mongols for this period, you need to delve into these sources extensively. And so I did that for my dissertation and, you know, earlier books and numerous articles. So this has been kind of a lodestar in all of my scholarship. And so, I mean, I've, you know, harvested passages here and there and, you know, historiographical interpretations and all the rest of it. And, you know, I mean, I'd been kind of cobbling together a translation for many years. I mean, this is a long text. You don't do a translation overnight. And ultimately what kind of forced my hand to really engage with it, pull it together was COVID. Basically March 2020, as everyone knows, everything came to a standstill, and pretty much, as with many other people, we're all in lockdown, and my brain wasn't working properly in order to delve into a serious monograph. And I thought, well, maybe I can go back to the precious summary and finally complete the translation. And so that's what I did during the lockdown.
So it sounds like you are one of the rare few that I think a lot of people entered lockdown with great and glorious plans. And it sounds a little like this great and glorious plan sort of came to fruition.
It did, actually, which is, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of a madman in various ways. But that's what I did during those somber months. Or year, whatever.
Yeah, somber years. I will say, you know, 2023, this does seem to be quite a year, or at least we seem to be moving in a period of some years that are particularly good in terms of translations of, you know, Mongol history sort of coming out. And I am, of course, thinking of The Secret History of the Mongols, which comes out later this year. So I know that you are, you know, personally sort of interested and invested in making primary sources about Mongol history more available. Is that something that, you know, do you feel like we're coming to that point? Is that sort of where the field is moving?
Well, I mean, one of the, you know, problems in this field is, of course, there's so few people who actually work with Mongolian sources. So it's kind of like, you know, the three or four of us who actually do it have to carry the brunt of the work, which is an uphill struggle. But of course, you know, Chris Atwood of Penn, who's coming out with his translation of The Secret History, which is coming out in the Penguin Classics series, which is going to be, you know, kind of revolutionary for the field. And that'll be great. And of course, he had his earlier translation that he did with Lynn Struve, going back to the good old Indiana University days, which is The Rise of the Mongols, five sources. I mean, those are Chinese sources, but looking at the rise of the Mongols before, you know, whatever, Genghis Khan or the unification of the empire. I mean, so that, and I understand that just won some big prize, and deservedly so. You know, so those two sources, and then this one, and then, you know, Professor Atwood and I are working on one of those sources series for the Columbia University Press Ancient Civilization series, where they have sources of Tibetan, sources of Korean, sources of Japanese and Chinese and whatnot. And so we're working on a sources volume for the Mongolian tradition. And that's a laborious laborious task, but it's coming together. And so, you know, with these other ones that have come out, and then that one, I think it'd be a real boon to the field.
No, absolutely. And I will say, you know, at least this reader is eagerly anticipating that Columbia series. So I'm sure there are others, but I will just speak for myself. Eagerly anticipated at least by one.
You're not the only one. A lot of people are kind of like, when's it going to be done? And I'm like, we're working on it. And so it will be done eventually.
Great. So thinking about, you know, just translation in general, as we're thinking about, you know, that other project, which is also involving translation, was there anything that was important to you as you were thinking about moving, as you were thinking about translating this book in particular, The Precious Summary? Was there anything that you found that you had to do to really make this 17th century Mongolian history, you know, legible and approachable to 20th, 21st century readers? Was there anything that, you know, you had to do to make this text work?
Well, I mean, in the field of Mongolian studies, I guess kind of our translation that we always look at and pointedly avoid not to do that, which is Francis Cleave's translation of The Secret History, which is kind of done in the King Jamesian English. But it was kind of like the only available source until Igor Dyrakhovils came out with his massive translation and commentary. And so in a certain sense, one thing that I really wanted to avoid, or is, obviously I'm not going to do a King Jamesian version because I wouldn't be able to do that, but I wanted to make it sensible to a modern reader. Again, this is complicated language. Obviously, it's from the 17th century, you know, vocabulary, terminology. And so, you know, I'm obviously want to be loyal to the text. I'm not making things up, obviously, but I did want to make it as readable as possible. And one of the reasons that the text is so highly prized in the Mongolian cultural world is because the language is incredibly rich and there's extensive use of poetry. One of the other Mongolian sources that I translated, The Jewel Translucent, which is an earlier from 1607, and it's the history of Altan Khan and his descendants. That one is written entirely in verse. And so I kind of had an experience working with Mongolian poetry. But so, you know, not only just making the prose legible and coherent to a modern reader, but I really wanted to kind of capture the poetry, which is a really, really important part that makes this work so meaningful in the Mongolian world. I mean, again, during the 17th century, there were several of these histories written basically kind of trying to understand or explain, you know, what happened with the Manchu conquest or the Mongol submission to Manchu authority. And of all of those sources, this is the one that became the masterpiece, so to speak. So I really wanted to have it speak in a certain sense to a modern reader. I mean, I think, you know, there's nothing worse to do with a translation and then somebody read it and like, this is terrible. Like, I don't want to read this. I succeeded in that regard. But the third point that I really wanted to do is provide historical and annotated notes. I mean, again, anybody who's coming to this, if, you know, I mean, again, the assumption is that, you know, people who do Chinese history as an undergraduate, they'll use sections of this in the course. And even if, you know, they have done, you know, Chinese history, even if the professors of Chinese history, they're not very necessarily familiar with Mongolian history or who these people are, you know, and all the events that are, you know, understood for the reader, for a Mongolian reader. And so I try to provide a lot of historical background. So, you know, anybody who's coming at it and, you know, sees all these names and places and events and, you know, so there's a large, you know, apparatus of historical information. So hopefully it makes it accessible to anybody coming at it.
Absolutely. There are extensive notes here that are extremely helpful and also, you know, very, again, just speaking on behalf of myself, the reader, extremely helpful in orientating and providing a reader with all of that background, which is, again, something I particularly appreciated. But you mentioned there, you know, the fact that this, you know, has been deemed to be, you know, a masterpiece. It was one of the exceptional sort of texts that came out from this period. And you touch on a little bit in the introduction of your translation, The Precious Summary, that this was, you know, prior to the rediscovery of the secret history of the Mongols, this was recognized as the history of the Mongols. So could you give listeners a little bit of a sense of that history? You know, where does this book sort of sit within the field? How has it been approached? There's a couple mentions here to sort of an earlier German translation, but how have scholars seen and used this text?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And, you know, I mean, again, I mean, I guess the first step of this process is that the Mongols themselves recognized this as, you know, the best source for their own history. And so it it was transmitted through manuscript versions, and there's many, many different versions across the Mongolian speaking world, and you know, as opposed to these other ones where there's like one exemplar or something. This is the text that everybody read, and you know, as a result of that, you know, eventually, when you know, during the Qing Empire, and there's this, you know, obviously, you know, Qianlong in particular is obsessed with collecting sources and making sure there's no anti-Manchu sentiment in these things. And so in 1777, you know, he commissioned an imperial block print of the text. And then that became the basis for a Chinese translation and then a Manchu translation. And so, you know, the interest kind of like exploded. The text had also gone into Tibet and then become part of the kind of the Tibetan historiographical tradition. And so, you know, when, you know, Western scholars started, you know, delving into this stuff in the early 19th century, you know, like, of course, they're like, well, what are the Chinese scholars reading? Or what are the Mongolians reading? What are the Tibetans reading? This is the source that everybody pointed to. But the real kind of factor that made it really, really big is that it was the first Mongolian text that was translated into German already in the 1820s by a Moravian missionary who was working among the Kalmucks in southern Russia, and which gives you a sense of the spread of the text that, you know, even the Kalmucks, this was part of their historical tradition. And so when that was translated into German, of course, it entered into the bloodstream of European Asian studies scholarship. And, you know, and pretty much anybody who was working on anything related to Inner Asia, I mean, of course, this was the time of like Klaproth, you know, trying to figure out who the Uyghurs were. And I mean, and Stanislaus Julien, you know, was working on all these, you know, the Uyghur and the Mongols and Tibetan historiography. And of course, you know, try to unpack what was going on. And, you know, Russian scholarship was trying to figure out what was going on in Central Asia. And this became kind of the go-to source, you know, that, you know, especially once it had been translated into German, it was readily available. And so anybody who was writing about Tibet or Xinjiang or Mongolia or the Qing or China as a whole, this was taken to be, you know, a legitimate, you know, accurate representation of history. And so pretty much anybody who was writing in the 19th century or European scholars would reference this work, you know, as you know, this is what happened kind of a thing. And so it was huge. And then it was only until, you know, when the secret history was rediscovered in the late 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century that people kind of moved away from this source and they kind of saw like, it was, you know, well, this was, there was a lot of fabulation and, you know, Buddhist stuff. And it wasn't really true history. And so then it kind of became demoted. And again, it was also the you know, the shift that happened with, you know, everybody wanted to focus on the empire or the contemporary period. And again, so the Ming Qing period fell out. And as a result of this source, I mean, obviously anybody who works on this period, you know, goes to this source. But ultimately it was supplanted by the secret history.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you for charting that out. With that, why don't we dive a little bit deeper into the text itself? You've sort of laid a few breadcrumbs in your sort of discussion of the history about what this contains and what it doesn't contain. So let's turn a little bit more to it. So as you say in the introduction, this is a coherent narrative of Mongol history from the creation of the universe up to the reign of the Kangxi Emperor, so 17th century. So this is a long history. And the precious summary is many things, to quote from the introduction again. It is a Buddhist cosmological history of the universe and proper rule, a history of Chinggis Khan, a history of the post-Yuan Mongols, a history of China, and also a history of the Mongols' Buddhist conversion. It is also a work trying to make sense of the new Manchu state. So with all of this, I think it is important to say up front that there is no way that we are even going to scratch the surface on the events and the names in this book. So interested listeners really do need to seek it out. But I did want to ask you about the beginning. So this book opens with the history of the universe, and it starts with the author telling us that he's going to explain how the world system, the external material world, was established. And, you know, for readers or listeners who are looking to this for a history of succession and leadership struggles and empire building, that might seem like a slightly odd place to begin with the history of everything. So why does the author start us here? And what do we need to take from this creation story?
I think the most important thing to recognize is that this is profoundly, it's a Buddhist work. There's no, again, of course, everybody knows that the Mongols, you know, converted to Buddhism. Altan Khan met the third Dalai Lama in 1578 and then set in motion the second conversion, as it's conveniently called. And then, of course, the standard explanation is, oh, well, you know, the Manchu Qing just kind of appropriated this Buddhist imperial project and the Mongols just, you know, whatever, willy-nilly just followed along because they were Buddhist or something like that. And that's kind of like the standard explanation. That's one of the bugbears or whatever that I've been kind of pushing against in a lot of my scholarship.
Please, listeners, seek out our great Qing.
Okay. Thank you for the plug. So this Buddhist narrative, obviously, it comes from the Tibetan tradition, and particularly, in the Mongolian context, it comes from Pakpa Lama, the guru of Kublai Khan, who initiated him into Tantric Buddhism in the 13th century. And he wrote this famous introduction to Buddhism for Kublai Khan's son, Jingim, who was the heir apparent, but then died before he could take the throne. But so this source is kind of the basis for Buddhist cosmological understanding and Buddhist political theory, and the kind of what they talk about, the two realms, that there's the realm of political power, which is in the hands of the secular ruler, the Khan, or in this case, or the emperor. And then there's the religious sphere, which is headed by a Tibetan Lama. And so these two work in a symbiotic relationship, and, you know, in order to make a functioning Buddhist state. And so this is a profoundly Buddhist work. I mean, the understanding is that, you know, to have a successful life and ultimately to achieve salvation, you know, you have to live in a Buddhist government, or you have to live in a Buddhist state. And so this, you know, the kind of the overarching narrative is, of course, you know, it goes back to the creation of the world. And this is goes back to, you know, a 5th century Indian Tibetan treatise, Vasubandhu's Abhidhammakosha. And, you know, it's the standard Indian Buddhist conceptualization of the cosmos. But then built into this is this political argument that, you know, the Dharma comes into the world, the Buddha appears and he teaches, you know, this is the path to salvation, the Four Noble Truths, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, again, in the modern West, as a result of mindfulness and all the rest of it, it's kind of stripped of its political context. But I mean, the Dharma was profoundly a political project, and particularly in East Asia. And so the understanding within the system is that, yes, you can be a Buddhist, but it's really, really good to be a Buddhist in a Buddhist state. And the Buddhist state, you know, is basically the vehicle that enables peace and prosperity to happen, but also provides the kind of the framework where you can actually do Buddhist meditation practice or whatnot and thereby achieve salvation. And so the whole premise of this text is that this is the kind of government that needs to work in order to achieve nirvana. And so the text, you know, starts with, you know, the creation, and then the Buddha, you know, reveals his revelation. And then the text explores Indian history and the great, you know, Ashoka, et cetera, and the great Buddhist rulers of India. But then, of course, you know, built into, you know, Buddhist kind of conceptualizations of humanity, humans are invariably greedy and stupid, and things go wrong. So, you know, the great Buddhist empires of India collapse. And then, of course, the mantle is taken up by the Tibetans. And then, of course, the same thing happens in Tibet. And then it's the Mongols, the Kublai Khan in particular, who picks up the mantle and creates a Buddhist empire, you know, out of Beijing. And then, of course, that collapses. And so the whole story is this, you know, you need to have a Buddhist empire. And so this is kind of like the undercurrent or thread that, you know, is to explain the Manchu Qing dynasty. They are the ones who revive the Buddhist mandate. And so, you know, it's kind of this four-part development. And so, you know, Sagan Sechen, I mean, in conventional or like, you know, modern or particularly communist historiography, Sagan Sechen is seen, you know, perennially, you know, the Mongols are always resisting Qing power. But I mean, he pretty much loves the Qing and the Manchus because they create a stable state where Buddhism can be practiced. And so that's kind of like the larger, you know, why begin at the beginning? Because that's, you know, that's how Buddhism works. And everything, you know, you have to have this political entity in order to have a true Buddhist world.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And as you just laid out, it very much, you begin at the beginning because it explains the end, then where this narrative comes to a close with the Manchus coming in and bringing about that, I don't want to say promised, but bringing about that ultimate Buddhist state. And we will get there. But you mentioned...
But I would say it is kind of a promise. I mean, it is kind of this kind of messianic kind of thing. They are righteous. They are good. I mean, and again, all the language that they use. I mean, there's that famous prophecy of the founder. You know, there's a comet comes through the sky, you know, and he's particularly pointed out that, you know, he is the Holy One, which is the term that they use for a righteous Buddhist ruler. And so that's like... The mark, and this famous figure in earlier in the narrative, basically pointing out to the Mongols, this is the guy we should follow, and so and they do.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there, I will stick with that language then, the promised ones. So thinking then of the unpromised ones, this history sort of takes us through the Yuan dynasty and. You make the point that the narrative sort of explains why the Mongols lost China, right? They give the unpromised ones, the ones who were not able to bring this political, were not able to complete what the Manchus ultimately do. So in the argument that's being sort of presented, the narrative that's being presented here, why did the Mongols lose China? What went wrong during that period?
According to Sagan Sechen or according to modern scholarship?
According to him. Yeah. How does he view it?
Yeah. Yeah. He's not talking about environmental disasters and, you know, inflation and those kind of things. No, I mean, the story that he tells about Zhu Yuanzhang is, of course, is completely fictional and completely made up. I mean, the story of, you know, that Zhu Yuanzhang is working for the last Mongol ruler and he's like, you know, his second son kind of figure. And then ultimately, you know, whatever, he steals the empire back. But undergirding all this is the whole history of the empire period is, you know, it's extremely truncated. And you know, I mean, again, now there's so many books and scholarship about the empire period and like the beginning of early modern world, etc. Of course, you know, Sagan Sechen doesn't care about that. All he cares about is how did the Mongol rulers relate to their Tibetan lamas and how did they create this Buddhist paradise? So these like, you know, short paragraphs, like this emperor takes over, his lama was this Tibetan person and they did all these great things. They published texts or they built stupas or they built monasteries or whatever. And then when it gets to the last ruler, Togon Timur, you know, basically he starts making mistakes in regards to the Dharma. And in particular, he doesn't listen to his Tibetan Lama. And this is kind of like, you know, the cause that ultimately results in the fall of the empire. You know, eventually, you know, all of this stuff is happening and they're trying to, the emperor or Togon Timur is trying to figure out, you know, what should I do? And, you know, he goes to his lama and his lama says, you should do this. And, you know, the Mongol ruler gets, you know, upset and says, I don't want to hear anything you have to say. You should leave and you should go back to Tibet. And so, you know, for the reader, this is, you know, if you're building a Buddhist empire, obviously that's not what you do. You don't kick out the Pope and say, you know, we're going Protestant or something. But that's pretty much what happens. And so that's the reason that the Mongols fell. And in this regard, Zhu Yuanzhang, I mean, again, it's very kind of counterintuitive, but, you know, in Mongol historiography, particularly of the 17th century period, I mean, the founding of the Ming is never seen to be a bad thing. Actually, it's a good thing. Basically, you know, the Mongols had basically messed it up, so to speak. They couldn't keep things together, which is, you know, the sine qua non of righteous Buddhist rule, that there is peace, there is stability, everybody gets food on time. But, you know, obviously when there's famine and earthquakes and, you know, the flooding of the Yellow River, things are not being done properly. And so Zhu Yuanzhang, you know, again, this the story builds up that he is good. I mean, he knows how to collect taxes and all this other stuff. And so when he comes in and takes over and the Mongols flee north, you know, it's, you know, the way that's presented is, well, Zhu Yuanzhang righteously and rightfully took the great state, and the Mongols were left to their own devices up on the steppe. And then, of course, then it becomes the civil war and all the rest of it. But again, it's basically the reason, I mean, according to the second section, is that they lost the Dharma. They, you know, and again, so this whole period becomes just one endless, you know, feud with the Oirats, or feud amongst themselves. And basically the reason that all this chaos happens is because they're not Buddhists. They've lost the faith. And so, you know, it's their own fault. And only until Altan Khan, you know, reconverts, so to speak, back to Buddhism, does the kind of the ship right itself and things can, you know, be proper again. But then there becomes civil war again between the various princes and the various Buddhist lineages. And then, of course, that civil war has to be brought to an end by the Manchus, who are seen as, you know, Bodhisattva Manjushri and all of that.
You mentioned that when, you know, chaos ensues, I guess, when after the Ming comes to power and the Mongols go north. And I think you describe it as operatic in terms of the Mongol-Oirat civil war that happens. And I mean, so much, it again, in this narrative, so much happens. You have demon possession. There is fratricidal murder. There is revenge being enacted by a basket boy. There is... Chinggis Khan murders a Khan he did not approve of with a mysterious arrow. There's a son being passed off as a daughter. There's a feast, and then there's bloodshed. I mean, there's a lot in this part of it. There's a lot that happens.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, I mean, you know, yes, it's, but I mean, if you come at it as, again, like, if you're coming at it as the thing about the undergraduate reader, this, you know, it would probably make a good Netflix special, but you know what I try to do with the notes is to explain, like, the background of this. I mean, so, like, basket boy Aruktai, I mean, he's actually the most powerful Oirat individual on the steppe. I mean, he's given all of these titles by the Ming court. He's even given the title Prince of Harahorum. So he was without a doubt the most powerful, you know, individual on the steppe. But again, he was Oirat, so he couldn't, you know, take any real authority because he wasn't Mongol or direct descendant of Chinggis Khan. And so that's what all those feuds are about, right? I mean, so who has the legitimacy? And so, yes, it's, you know, all of these sexual scandals and, you know, and then the murder as a result of that. And so, you know, this is the way that the story is told, but hopefully the notes can kind of explain, you know, the background to this kind of fantastical telling of it.
Oh, absolutely. And if anything, you know, in thinking of the overall sort of goal of the narrative, all of this chaos is, as you just indicated, sort of also pointing to the fact that, you know, these people were not the legitimate rulers, right? This is not ideal what they were doing, right? That it very clearly presents them as sort of discredited, for they do not have the legitimacy and they are unable to create the proper Buddhist state. And in thinking about, you know, things that, you know, caught my eye, there's a lot of different, you know, queens, there's a lot of different women, there's mothers who are, you know, very important, who, you know, give birth to various sons, and then there's queens and to, you know, soon to be wives and mothers who refuse to marry because the one that they're marrying is not the proper descendant of Chinggis Khan. There's a lot of, you know, very important, you know, political figures in this who are women. And I don't specifically have a very targeted question here, except just to ask you, I'm curious if there's anything that you think is worth noting about this. Are there any particular female characters, or, you know, again, in the narrative, who stand out to you in how they're being presented, or is there anything unusual here, or is this all very typical?
I mean, in one sense, it's pretty typical. We know, that Mongol women did have a lot of power, especially in the empire period. You know, all of these regencies, you know, when they could, like after Munca or whatever, they couldn't choose who was going to be the proper ruler. And it was always the wives or the mothers who were kind of like the power behind the throne who were pushing this and all this other stuff. And Kublai Khan's wife is, of course, famous as being very, very important, including playing a role in the conversion. And so historically, Mongol women have had a lot of power and been very, very prominent, politically, economically. One of the reasons that they had this power was just because of the tradition of my brain's not working, of marriage, where they retained their dowry. And so one of the most, powerful queens in the story, and historically, is Altan Khan's third wife, this famous called Queen Jongin. And, and we know historically that she married four successive sons and again, it was the Chinese, she was kind of seen as being an ameliorating force. This was at a time of, basically the Ming Dynasty was falling apart and they couldn't maintain the garrisons. And the Mongols were just kind of running rampant over North China and marauding and looting. And so she was seen, after Altan Khan passed away, that she could kind of, keep the youngsters in check, so to speak. And so she was, in order to, act as a kind of a pro-Chinese agent, so to speak, the Ming court gave her titles and all these other things. But she had an enormous power. She was without a doubt probably one of the most important political figures and economic powers on the steppe in the late 16th century. I think one of the interesting things, and I've written an article about this, is that she is pretty much the last powerful Mongol woman we hear about. After her, women disappear in the Mongol historical tradition. One of my arguments is that it was Buddhism that kind of clipped the wings of women. Women kind of fell out of the historical narrative completely in the Qing period. But so in this earlier pre-Buddhist period, Mongol women, without a doubt, had a huge amount of power. And she was definitely the power behind the throne for at least three decades.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for explaining that. As we're sort of moving to the end of the narrative, we see much of the narrative revolving around a few key issues. So we have the Chinggisid legitimacy coming to an end, decentralization and infighting continuing, and then the adoption of Buddhism. And with all of this, we see the notion of where political authority and legitimacy, really lies. We see this sort of changing and morphing. Is there any particular part of the narrative that encapsulates these tensions for you? Is there anything here that you want to really emphasize as a place where you see this playing out?
I don't know. That's a great question, but it's also a really hard question. I can't think of, one episode or something, but whatever, to lay my cards on the table. And, Buddhism has such a, positive connotation in the West. And I guess that's been one of my kind of, scholarly kind of projects to kind of problematize that thing. And so again, you read, the conventional Mongolian histories, like once they convert to Buddhism, everything's great, everything's hunky-dory, and then they're on their path to salvation or whatever. But it was really the conversion. The disempowerment of women is probably in today's world not seen as being a great thing. But obviously, that was one of the consequences of a Buddhist conversion. And elsewhere I've looked at kind of the impact on legal systems, right? Buddhism comes in and, rejiggers Mongol conceptualizations of justice. And again, with the conversion and the political power, you know, this basically fuels the civil war that you know, that is kind of the fuel that results in all of these different princes making alliances with the Manchus. You know, again, Buddhist legitimacy is the vision. And so once Altan Khan converts and says, you know, and again, he's an illegitimate heir to the throne. He's not a direct descendant of Genghis Khan, so he can't claim the throne, even though he is the most powerful ruler on the steppe. But once he converts, you know, that basically sets, reanimates the kind of the Buddhist vision. And so then pretty much any one of these other Dayan Hanit princes can convert and align with the Tibetan Lama of different lineages of the Kagyu or the Sakya or whatnot. And so, you know, setting up, you know, their involvement in Tibetan civil war at the same time. But, you know, so this is the beginning, you know, so Buddhism comes in, you know, for all the good things that it does, but it also enables this kind of decentralization. All of these princes can say, well, I'm a descendant of Dayan Khan, so I'm basically a descendant of Genghis Khan, and now I'm a Buddhist, and my Lama is XYZ, and so I've created my little Buddhist utopia, and I'm going to go fight my brother who's, you know, has another Lama, and, you know, claim their territory. And this is a civil war. And this not only, you know, in among the Mongols, but it's also, you know, it becomes in Tibet, and then it's with the Khalkh, you know, and they break away, and then of course with the Dzungars. I mean, so basically you have a four-way civil war going on in the 17th century over political legitimacy and who is the rightful, you know, Buddhist state, right? I mean, the Dalai Lama says, I'm the rightful, you know, Galden Khan among the Dzungars says, I'm the rightful one, you know, and the Khalkh do the same thing. They create the Jetsun Dampa of Tuktu. And of course, the Manchu Qing is doing their thing. So you have a four-way civil war. And of course, this isn't basically settled until, you know, Qianlong, you know, destroys the Dzungars. But so this kind of conversion and this kind of decentralization, you know, again, you know, to problematize the Buddhist narrative, everybody thinks, oh, well, this is a great thing, but it has all these consequences because of the political power, especially when it's linked with the Chinggisid principle and, you know, who has the right to rule. And once you open up the Pandora's box, well, I'm a Buddhist and I'm a descendant of Dayan Khan, anybody can claim to be the rightful ruler. And that's exactly what happens. And so that's the civil war and the kind of the undergirding for all of these princes. You know, first they're fighting amongst themselves, they're fighting the Tibetans, and then eventually, you know, there's Ligden Khan, and they're like, all right, we're going to align with the Manchus, and we're going to settle this, and then we'll create a, you know, a Buddhist super state that we're all subservient to.
And it really sort of ends with that Buddhist super state. The narrative ends with this, you know, this vision of peace and unity. Thus, by the grace of this Lord Khan, all the vast people had their desires fulfilled and rejoined with their hands and feet resting on the ground. We sort of end, the narrative ends here with the validity of the decision to side with the Manchus being sort of supported, right? You have the Mongols being shown to be, you know, chaotic and fragmentary, and then the Manchus being blessed by heaven and pious Buddhists. But as we sort of look to the end of the narrative and look to, you know, the end of our conversation, is there anything about this narrative that we haven't had a chance to talk about that you want to emphasize here? Is there anything that we haven't covered that you want to highlight?
Oh, yeah. sorry, I'm kind of I'm struggling to think of something. I mean, I'm sure there's a million things, but again, I think it's what is important. I mean, again, going back to where I started with like the Ming Qing period, everybody thinks that we don't have sources from this period. And in particularly, you know, again, we have a lot of Chinese sources, which of course are incredibly biased, as everyone knows. And so these kind of sources exist, and there's other ones, a lot of other ones that are just beginning to be tapped by scholars that give us a really kind of, you know, totally fascinating perspective on this period, and particularly this part of the world. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, I was on a dissertation defense at the University of Pennsylvania, and it was one of Chris Atwood's students who was defending her dissertation on the cult of Genghis Khan and the history of the cult. And of course, you know, there all the other faculty are in the room, and you know, and she defended her dissertation incredibly well and passed and all the rest of it, which was wonderful. But you know, at the end of it, all of the Penn faculty, the sinologists, were pointed out, like, I guess a month earlier, another graduate student at Penn had defended a dissertation on the Ming garrisons. And they were all just like completely stunned of like how radically different, you know, the life in the Ming garrison and the Chinese sources that you can talk about, and then what was going on in Mongolia. And that's pretty much just, you know, 50 miles away. And, you know, completely two totally different universes, you know, but happening simultaneously. And again, you know, all the questions like, what is China? You know, what is Chinese history? What should we talk about? And all the rest of it. You know, I think these kind of sources for anybody who studies Chinese history, these are the kind of sources, you know, again, you know, not to like go back to like the 1619 argument or whatever, but I mean, again, you know, or the whole New Qing history and all the rest of it, you know, to understand Chinese history, we need to understand that there's a lot more going on within the contemporary boundaries of the PRC. We can't understand, you know, Chinese history without talking about the Mongols, without talking about the Tibetans, without talking about the Uyghurs or whoever. And so these sources are incredibly valuable, kind of like, I don't know, to use Drew Gladney's old term, destabilizing China. And so I think that's one of the important things of these sources, not only just to understand the Mongols, but to understand pretty much all of East Asian history. And so could even go back to, you know, the 19th century scholarship, you know, all of those people, you know, I think like Paul Pelliot or whoever, they were all multilingual, all working in multiple sources. And I think now we kind of live in a monolingual world and sinological scholarship, which is, I think is really unfortunate. And so again, these sources provide us, you know, very interesting new perspectives on how to think about what is and was China.
Absolutely. So now that you've come to the end of this book and your COVID project, at least this little part of what you were doing during that time, what are you working on now? What are you working on next? You talked about a few little things at the beginning. I don't want to say little in the certain terms of scope and scale, but just sort of small, minor things maybe. What are you working on at the moment, though?
Well, you know how like academic publishing works. It's a long, drawn out process. So I actually have one book that's in press right now, and it's a history of Uyghur Buddhism. Again, this is kind of going back to my first book which I did was a survey of Uyghur Buddhist literature. And it's obviously been an interest of mine for, well, the last 25 years, basically. And, you know, considering the current situation, I felt it imperative to write history. I mean, obviously there's enormous amount of scholarship on this, but it's in German and Japanese and Russian. And, you know, again, a lot of China scholars, a lot of Buddhologists, a lot of Inner Asianists don't know this chapter of that history. And so so that's what I did, and it's currently in press. Hopefully will be out in the near future. So what I'm actually working on now, it's a very strange thing, but I'm posthumously finishing Thomas Olson's last book. I was asked by his families and executors. He'd been writing a book on the history of alcohol. And I mean, it was kind of envisioned initially as like the Royal Hunt in Eurasian history, kind of a big history of alcohol across Eurasia. But with the material that I've gotten, it's basically going to become a history of alcohol in the empire, like his book on pearls. So alcohol in the empire and the successor, whatever, Mongol states, whatever you want to call it. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Oh, wow. So they both sound like fascinating projects. One nearing its end, I guess, of its lifespan in terms of academic publishing.
Well, it's in the press's hands, so it's off my desk. I'm done with that with the Uyghur project, but I'm in the thick of the alcohol project, which is kind of pushing me to drink more alcohol, which is probably not a good thing.
Well, best of luck with that. Not with the alcohol drinking, but with the working on the alcohol. And, you know, best of luck with that. I hope to hear more about it. But thank you for taking the time to talk with me about this book.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was great.